where you can raise concerns about the rates, but because you're not a resident of that city, then you don't have the access to the ballot box as you described. That happens in a variety of contexts.
And businesses frequently choose to locate where tax and fee policies are favorable to their business. Would you suggest that a resident, if they don't like those fees, should find another place to live?
So we asked another question that I think addresses what you're raising. The question is whether or not the city has a policy on how additional properties outside the city may get access to retail water. Has that? That addresses the point, if you're a user outside of the city, how do you get access to that water? What's the process? Is it a fair process? And so it was an open-ended question, so there was feedback from these city respondents. So I'll list the different comments that came back. First, you come before the city council for approval or agreement, and the service costs are defined therein. So that's the opportunity for the user outside of the city to speak before the city council, meet the city council, and define those costs and negotiate those costs. Another one of the comments was that the city provides access to that retail water if you're part of the annexation plan or if you're part of the master plan service area. Another, several cities reference that in order to provide that additional water, that user has to be on an existing main water line or have approval from the city to extend the water line. Some cities extend the water to address emergency situations. And then there are a couple of cities that will provide the water to existing residential units but not for agricultural uses so that they can meet the actual demand for the residences rather than agriculture. So again, the issue is more, is there a process in place for that individual who's receiving water outside of city boundaries to have a forum and have an opportunity to discuss the rates with the council, similar to how a business owner or a developer or anybody else could come before the city when they are paying fees or paying taxes to the city? The answer is yes.
So I would suggest that that's maybe not the question. The question is, are the water users empowered to affect their water rates? And typically citizens are empowered through an elective representative process. And we've got 30 years of communication of county officials and legislators concerned about this disenfranchisement. I don't know that we can equate water use with a business licensing fee. That would be ridiculous.
I'm not equating it to a business license fee.
Necessary. I think the question should be, are they fully empowered as the extra jurisdictional users, as the citizens of the distributing city? Are they equally empowered to affect their rates? Not just hear about them, not just be able to speak out about them, not just to be informed, but are they equally empowered? Or is there a disenfranchisement that's been suggested for 30 years? And I'm not sure the survey answers that question, or actually maybe it does. Sounds like it does. The respondents seem to think that it's enough to let them be able to speak in a council meeting, and I would submit that is not equal.
I think they clearly are in a different position than citizens of the city, and I don't think, I mean, the survey's indicating that the town's doing their best or doing something to try to help them feel included, but they're obviously not part of the city, and so they're in a different position than people who are part of the city.
Yeah, there are different legal rights that come from being a resident and benefiting from all of the public services that a city provides versus being non-resident and benefiting from just a single service. The correlation I was making with a business owner in the city is not about the business license fee. It's that business owner is served by roads, sewer, water, and the entire litany of public services that a city provides. And that business owner doesn't have a vote if he or she resides in a different city. But there are processes in place to make sure that business owner is still treated fairly under the law. And cities, based on the survey responses, are trying to ensure that there are still those fair processes in place. Another survey question we asked that addresses the underlying issue of whether or not a city could arbitrarily cut off someone's access to water, which is the worst-case scenario of the disenfranchisement that you've referenced. The responses from the city is that the disconnection comes because of non-payment or cross-connection violations. And several cities said we treat them the same as any other resident, non-payment or waste or other things that if a resident did that could cost them their water, a non-resident is treated the same way. So the other option that a city referenced was that if a customer moves to a different public water supplier, then we work that out, or if there's disconnection and they're annexed into another city. So, in other words, there is no city that is out there willy-nilly, arbitrarily cutting off water. There is still that process in place where the water user outside of the city is treated the same as a water user inside the city. And that's where the fairness and the due process is still in place.
So I think in our consensus observations, we need to recognize that there is this disenfranchisement or potential disenfranchisement. And of course, our concern about water termination, supply termination, is not based on a consumer not paying a bill. Clearly, that's not what we've been talking about. We've been talking about contracts that represent that the serving city could terminate the water for really any reason, because the contracts don't stipulate that it would be limited to non-payment. And that's where some of the constitutional questions come in, that it is apparent that the contracts anticipate that this distribution could be terminated for any reason. So we need to, in our consensus observations, that would be another one, that there is this concern about water, the ability of the serving city to terminate. And it is not restricted by non-payment.
And we'll talk about the consensus observations in a minute. This is Cameron's reporting on his survey, so there may be others or significant discussion about those issues. So if you can hold that for that part of the discussion, that would be helpful.
Boyd, the last couple of questions that I'll report on, and then we can have a discussion from there, we asked, do you provide culinary water on a wholesale basis outside of your city boundary? And of the 47 respondents, only 5 said that they do. And then we asked, how is that wholesale rate determined? One city said through negotiation. A couple said based on cost. One said tied to our wholesale water purchase contract pricing. And another said as part of the standard city water rate structure. Then as a follow-up to that is asked how the wholesale water supply could be terminated. And it said the supply agreement includes the termination language, or it's outlined in an agreement between the city and other entities with notice provisions.
Thank you. I have one question, Cameron. Do you think the percentage of responses that they're serving to the number that actually reported is indicative of the total number of municipalities and what the ratio would be? Or do you think your survey was most likely responded to by just cities that were serving outside their boundary?
We made a big push when the survey went live to get the information in, or get the survey in front of cities that provide their own water. As we were reviewing the results yesterday, we found that there were several cities that we know provide water that had not yet responded, and so we reached out to those cities yesterday, and my colleague gives back the office for reaching out to them again today. That said, 47 cities with a wide variety of respondents, I think it gives a good snapshot, not a complete snapshot, but a very good snapshot of what's happening around the state.
Okay. So, I mean, based on the responses, then it's obviously at least probably half of the cities are serving outside their boundary, if this is representative.
Yep.
Is that what you're telling us?
Yep, and certainly during the legislative session, we heard from cities all over the state who were concerned because they were providing water outside of their boundaries, and it's communities as small as Torrey that provide water outside of their boundaries. So it's not just an urban area situation, certainly not just a Salt Lake City situation. We've seen it from communities all over the state.
Okay. Thank you. Are there other questions for Cameron about the survey? All right.
Did the survey include circumstances where city water, municipal water, is being served not through a retail or a wholesale situation, but just by permissive use through change application, where cities have a change application, they change and they allow private parties to divert and use municipal water assets?
No, that was not part of this portion of the survey.
Mm-hmm. Other questions? Okay. Thank you, Cameron. The other question we should ask is, are there other things that we would like to learn about this that would be helpful that Cameron might be able to get?
Yeah, likewise, follow-up questions that come out of these preliminary results, recognizing that we are following up with another dozen or so communities that we expected results from.
Yes.
I have a friend that actually went to one of the public hearings in Salt Lake City. Her name is Nancy Carlson Gotts, and she's from Mill Creek. And she went for the hearing on the rate increase. And maybe it's the process with which and how she made her presentation and how she was responded to that needs to be reviewed. As far as she was not given her answers right there at the meeting, they said, we'll get with you later, and they sent her an email. I was just trying to find that email of the response. I will send it to you as soon as I can locate it, because it shows you the example with how, and mind you, this is clinical. They had no idea that I had asked her to go. And she went, and she was the only resident from Mill Creek that went. Because a lot of people don't really understand the gravity of when they get a notice and what they should do to follow up. I do believe those cities need to be involved on the East Bench. I've even asked if Jeff Silvestrini was invited to these meetings. In one place it says no, and he says no, and from a third party I'm hearing yes. So I think there's a lot of confusion. The people that need to be at this table are those water users on the East Bench and the processes with which they're engaged. So I have a problem when I'll talk to you after the meeting. I've been to a lot of city meetings where instead of on public record discussing the answers, they are actually diverting people to off-the-record conversations after the meetings and or via email. I'll get back to you. So that, yes, there is a process, but it has some issues.
Well, and yeah, and I I don't think that's something Cameron can get to in a survey. So whether people feel satisfied with the process.
I'm not saying anything against Cameron. I'm just saying we ran a test to see how Salt Lake City dealt with it, and that's exactly how they dealt with it.
Okay. Are there any other questions anyone would like to have answered from the cities on a survey?
I'm just wondering if a process that's very old here is equitable when the number of people served outside the cities is equal to the number of people served inside the cities.
And
that is a disturbing thing. They don't have a vote, I understand. Property, water is property, I understand. But all of Salt Lake County is served by several water districts that sell water, but I don't know that the water districts represent the majority even of the people they serve.
And I, taking that to a question that could be addressed, I guess, and I don't know if it can be, is there any way, Cameron, to get a sense of what the proportion of the water served outside the community is versus the proportion in the community? Or do you think that you would unlikely get much response to that?
I think the bigger question is what do we need that data for?
I think that's very important.
I think the question is, do you provide it, yes or no? Because in the case of the town of Torrey, they provide a lot of water outside of their town. Proportionally, it's a good chunk of Wayne County for which Torrey provides water. Does it matter the number of connections, or does it matter that they have a good process and that it's transparent? I guess the question is, before we start digging and trying to collect all of that type of data, what's the end objective for it?
I think that's a fantastic question because there's a certain burden on the municipality to provide water to its residents. But if it's become a larger enterprise of distributing outside of the district, or it's become outside of that jurisdiction, or it has become a significant portion of the water portfolio, I think that raises some questions about the propriety of that function of a municipality.
And I guess my interest is, I know that there are a number of different reasons cities are serving outside their boundary. And I think in most cases they're trying to be helpful, in all cases. But one of the questions that might be relevant, or one of the issues that we might could address, is if we had a better understanding of why they choose to do that instead of annexing or providing water another way, would be helpful for us to understand as we talk about prospective legislation. So I'm just trying to get a sense of, are most of them just serving small groups that they think are going to annex, or are there a lot of them serving outside their boundary with the idea they're just going to serve water over a large area? That it'd be helpful to us.
We get requests from citizens who say it's more reliable, you're not that far away, can we connect your system?
Yeah. I think that's one challenge. Well, it depends on how you ask a question, I think. But to know why they serve is, I think, that's so fact dependent. I don't know how you recapture that in a survey. Trying to figure out, you know, number of connections, that might be something you can figure out. But to know why, you know, were these people expected to annex or not, and maybe they are now and maybe they won't in the future, I'm not sure how to capture that information, but because it's so fact.
And we don't want it misconstrued, because it certainly is not a territorial thing. It's because it just seems reasonable to serve someone who's close to one of our lines and doesn't have reliable water source and otherwise couldn't utilize their property.
Richard?
That question
could be helpful as we try to craft some solution going forward. But in many cases, it's a moot point because of opportunities that have been precluded in subsequent actions. An example would be the many residents served by Salt Lake City in areas that now have incorporated into their own cities, Holiday, Mill Creek, Cottonwood Heights. And so if there was an opportunity that the residents assumed was available at some point in the future that they could annex, that option is gone. And so it seems to me that we ought to focus on a solution going forward for the residents who are currently served outside city boundaries and for the process that ought to be followed in the future so that they know what their status is and have fair treatment.
Okay. Thank you. Any other items that we want to ask Cameron about?
Did we decide? I think the question could be just as simple as how many connections do you have inside? How many connections do you have outside? It's just a straight comparison. That's not a difficult question to ask. And it does give you some sense of proportion.
But can I ask the follow-up question of why?
If they want to volunteer that, that's fine. But to me, it's like my district, we have 7 people, 7 connections outside my service area. Okay, and the reasons are, transfer services. But 7 compared to 5,000 is not much. Okay, that's different than if I had, 2,000 outside my service area, I was providing service to 5,000.
But the underlying policy we're trying to achieve is better communication, better transparency. It doesn't matter if it's 7 or 2,000 in your example. The proportion doesn't matter. What matters is the underlying policy.
I understand, but the question does not hurt to ask. Facts help, even if it's not that important. But it'd be nice to know how big an issue is this really out there.
I think the data point that half of the respondents provide water outside of their municipal boundary, I think that is very useful information.
It is.
It doesn't matter if it's one connection.
Just asking for a follow-up, Cam. It's nothing, it's not difficult. Just ask them the question.
Sure.
This is no different than what Representative Coleman's maps were seeking last session.
No, I think it is a little different. The map, if memory serves, the map was outlining what the areas were that were served outside of the municipal boundary, but it wasn't highlighting the number of total connections. Because that's not just about population, that's about every sort of retail connection that exists. So, again, that can be misconstrued.
All right. And I just want to know if you're going to ask the question or not.
Well, and it may not be the best venue to ask the question. I mean, I think as a planning issue, sooner or later we're going to have to get to that question with cities, but we can ask it directly in our water use reporting and things to understand that better and make sure that that's being planned for. And so I'm looking for things. I've been very appreciative of you doing the survey and bringing this information here so we can get an understanding of what's really going on out there. And so, to the extent that there are things that we don't understand and we can put some numbers to it, it's helpful for us to understand it better. And so I appreciate what you've done. And there are things we'd all like to know that we're just not going to get this way. And so if there are practical things we think the league can get answers to, I think.
I just have a point of clarification to the answer of why. For many of them, it could be as simple as they purchased the water system that was outside their area and brought it into their supply of water service.
And I think that may be one instance, but I think there's a whole series of different reasons. I recognize that probably there's 20... If there's 23 respondents, there's probably 23 different reasons.
In each city, there may be
more than one reason.
10 to 20
different. Yeah.
So. I would tend to point out that for one city, there may be five or six or a dozen reasons. It will vary depending on the area that they serve.
Okay. All right. Well, I do appreciate you bringing that information to us, and I think it's helpful because it confirms what we thought just based on what we were seeing earlier, that there seemed, the more we looked, the more it seemed like there's more of this going on than anyone perceived was going on earlier. So, and so that's helpful. Thank you. I next wanted to move to this handout that's on the back table, and I emailed out to those that we send emails out to. What I was trying to do is, in our committee, we've talked about these issues quite a bit, and what I'm trying to do is get focused on what is the current state of affairs in the state, what is the law, where are we at, so then as we look at whether that's where we want to be, we'll know where we're at and have some direction about how to get to a different place. And so I put together, Mark did give me some input, Mark Stratford, and so I modified the document a little bit based on his input. But I take responsibility for the authorship of this. So if you're angry about it, blame me. Because based on what I've heard in the meetings, I tried to go do some research and just gather some observations about where I thought we were at. And so I don't know how many of you had time to look at those before the meeting, but I'd like to just go through these observations and see if there's consensus that that is where we are at, or if there's disagreement that that's really where we're at. Is kind of what I'd like to understand. So I'll just go through one by one, and if there are thoughts or concerns about each one, please bring them up, okay? And then we'll talk about whether there are other things that I haven't observed that are the state of affairs, okay? So the first one is about the Constitution, that it currently prohibits municipalities from alienating their water rights, water supply, and waterworks. It acknowledges that they can make exchanges of equal value, and charges municipalities to supply with their resources water to their inhabitants at reasonable charges. So, is there any concerns about that?
I think she's calling back in.
Did you come up with that, or was that Mark?
Almost all of this is his. I only have like two lines in here.
Are you still there, Representative Holman? Or Coleman?
Yes, I am. I think that first one is full of legal assumptions that I'm not entirely sure are accurate. Just because we may have a number of people that agree on it doesn't mean it's so. So I would still like our ledge research to give us some more opinions on those things.
And I called it observations because I obviously didn't want to give you a legal opinion because I'm not a lawyer.
Yeah, so I think it's important that we follow up with having the legal answers because, again, it just because it may be our opinions doesn't make it consistent with the law and the Constitution.
Okay. Is there concern that this isn't consistent with what the Constitution says?
I think there is concern that we're not having that direct conversation yet. And so if we don't have a firm foundation on what the law is, it's hard to continue conversations based on assumptions that we don't have verified.
Can we ask whose advice she's asking for?
Ledge research. Ledge researches. Legislative research.
who are attorneys who advise the legislature, not the Attorney General's office. They advise the legislative branch.
Representative Coleman, could I make a suggestion? Would you share this with legislative research and get their take on what their views are for us for the next meeting?
Yes, absolutely. And I thought Ruth Ann would be at this meeting. Is she? I can't see.
No, I don't see her. She hasn't had her baby yet then?
Oh, that's right. That's right.
I think, but I don't see her replacement here either.
Well, I think that's a good suggestion. She could send that to legislature.
Yeah, we'd love to have that happen. So if you would like to take that to legislative research and get us some feedback about their views, that'd be helpful.
And I don't have the ability to ask the AG's office. That's a different process, but where this is a legislative endeavor,
yeah,
it would be appropriate to engage ledge research.
Okay. Thank you.
I'll do that. You bet.
Fred.
When we get to the constitutional part, we might want to have the members of that give us their opinion so that we'd have their opinion of what they think the Constitution is, and then we can compare that with legislative research and the council's opinion.
Okay.
Yeah. Let's just keep going.
All right. Well, is there any other comments on number one, concerns? All right. Let's go to number two. Cities are authorized by statute to sell surplus product or capacity to others beyond the limits of their municipality. Any concerns about that? Rich.
I'm glad we're talking about observations, not legal opinions, because I'm not an attorney. But this, I think that's accurate. But it almost begs another sentence that says, this is clearly in violation of the Constitution prohibition, and in Utah, the Constitution is the highest law, and the statute with different language, as far as I understand, doesn't trump the Constitution. It's the other way around,
but
and that's why there is a problem that we're all trying to work on.
And Mark, I didn't include the sentence he was going asked me to add to one. There is no prohibition in the Constitution about providing surplus capacity to others. It just says you won't alienate those works and you'll use them to supply your inhabitants. So if you have more than you need to supply your inhabitants, I'm not sure there is a prohibition about using it another way.
Yeah. That was my comment, and there may be some debate about that, but I think it's a fair comment. I think Paulina has.
I think the conflict is again in the definition is that the Constitution is dealing as an asset. So when we say sell surplus, are we talking about the water right as the surplus? Are we talking retail service? I think that's where your whole problem lies, is in the retail service versus selling an actual commodity. A commodity is an asset. Or if you're selling it as a, like getting rental money or whatever you're doing with it, there's a huge difference in selling that water right. And you have to define whether this surplus product means water right or just retail service.
And because the Constitution is explicit about not selling it, I think you're not selling your water right. You're only selling surplus product that you could get back if it's no longer surplus. All right. Any other comments about that one? Number three. Local districts have no constitutional prohibition on alienating water and facilities, but districts can only be created for a limited number of purposes and are generally limited by statute to provide services within its boundaries. Like municipalities, local districts are authorized to sell surplus product or capacity services to others beyond the local district boundary. And we talked a little about that. Richard told us that they have one instance where they're providing service outside their boundary, And I presume other districts are doing that to some extent, just like cities are.
Yes, in our case, the Jordan Valley provides standby contract water to Copperton Improvement District for a fixed, short fixed time only, not perpetually, and outside of our boundaries. And I believe that's how the other water conservancy districts operate.
Okay. Any other concerns, discussion about that? And then number four, water conservancy districts have broad authority to contract with others for joint operations. And that goes again to what Richard's just talking about. They can do that. Number five, providing water service outside the boundary of a municipality is a fairly common practice among Utah cities. The extent to which districts are providing services outside their boundary is less well known, but is known to be occurring. And I think Cameron just reinforced that. At least half of the respondents said they are doing that. Did somebody have a comment on
that? I didn't know if Dale had any observation on that, or if you have any reason to know anything.
No input. Okay, thank you, Dale.
I think you should make a distinction between this explicitly says providing water services, and I think people frequently take that to mean that the city is delivering water through infrastructure that's either owned or controlled by them. In Salt Lake County, there's this very significant amount of municipal water that is being used, but it's being diverted. It's public municipal water, but it's being diverted by private parties on private property, delivered through private infrastructure. And I think that is really the water you got to focus on. Whether it's you're characterizing it as water service, retail, or wholesale, you're missing the faction of water that is out there where the city or the conservancy district has infrastructure or means to divert and deliver. And you need to pay attention to the places in the county where it's municipal water diverted and used by private parties on private property and that can be terminated, or so says some people.
And I guess maybe that is a survey question. I don't know if it is a survey question that you could get to, but maybe that's something to ask if there are others that are doing something similar to what Salt Lake is doing. I know of at least one that is, where rather than providing retail or wholesale service, they're actually just allowing people to use their water right to develop their own water supply. Do you think they would respond to that?
Let us try to figure out a question that could be answered in a way that is meaningful.
Okay.
Because that's the tricky thing with survey questions, is trying to get information that has context.
The way to make that a specific question is to query your members, how many parties are you selling water to that you do not provide the infrastructure and diverting works for the diversion and delivery, period.
It'd be interesting to know how much of that's going on, if you can find a way to get at that. Other concerns with this particular observation?
Do we want to make that practice unlawful?
I'm not expressing views right now about whether it should or shouldn't be happening. Just trying to understand what is happening. Okay. All right. Number six. Although a city's generally protected against legislatively created oversight groups, the Public Service Commission has ruled that if the city purchases a utility providing service outside the city, which was subject to PSC oversight, the jurisdiction continues until the PSC decides it is no longer necessary. I think that came from what you told us earlier.
That's what the ruling was by the Public Service Commission. And that was never overturned in the Supreme Court.
Was never litigated either, I don't think, was it?
It never went to the courts.
Yeah. The quasi-judicial body of the PSC, it has judicial capacity, made that decision. And the appeal process from their decision was the Supreme Court. It was filed in the Supreme Court, but then later withdrawn.
So we never really got a decision on it, but that's the state of affairs right now.
Right.
Yeah. I presume if the same situation came up again, the PSC would say the same thing.
So it's available for those that wish to proceed and test it again.
That's the question. I don't know if that's the constitutional.
Yeah.
Exactly, but we'll get that from. That's legal.
Yeah. Okay. Any other concerns with that observation?
Many situations, is that just an outlier or is it a prevailing practice?
I think that's more of an outlier myself, but I don't know that answer to that. I guess maybe that's a question the cities would be willing to answer, Cameron, is whether they're buying private water companies to bring into their municipality. You see how widespread that practice is. I don't know the answer to that.
Ask Aaron.
All right. The Supreme Court in Platt versus Town of Torrey found that the charges for service outside a municipality must be based on some rational basis. This does not mean the charges must be limited to the minimum required to provide the service or based on the actual cost to provide the service, just that the rate must be reasonable, meaning there must be some rational basis. I read the case and that's what I got out of the case, so that's I guess that is my opinion. Did someone get something different out of that case? Have different views of?
I think
be great.
We don't have enough data yet to tell us whether that we have any practices that might exceed that standard, or what might be considered unreasonable.
Well, this case was about unreasonable. That's why this case was filed, was the parties felt it was unreasonable, and they got this decision.
Yeah.
Right, and so I don't know if we have any practices right now that could be deemed unreasonable. And if there's a potential for abuse, is there a way that we can prevent abuses short of an individual having to go to court? Are there ways, like, I mean, that's what our PSC is really for, right? Is to create equity and fairness and reasonable practices with due process and with good standards. So if we were to learn that there might be abuse, would we want to maybe look at creating different standards? But I don't think we have enough information yet.
Okay.
I don't think the best solution is to always leave things to the courts. Because sometimes that's very difficult for people to access. But I think as we get more data, we can see if there appears to be abuses.
Okay.
Boyd?
Yes.
Does anyone here know, has anyone actually tried to use toy in litigation since that case? I've never heard of anything.
Yeah.
Scott, are you aware of anything?
Yeah, it's been used extensively, but it's been attempted to be used extensively for something that it is not. It's a rates case, and that's what it is. It's a rates case. And we've made that argument now probably half a dozen times, and each time the court agrees.
Okay, I'm just wanted to see what the state was right now, if it actually gives a standard that can actually be applied, or if it's just a one of these nice things we talk about but never use.
Well, I think,
Paul, I think your question is has it been used in a case where there are, you know, it's whatever's reasonable. That's a fact. I mean, you know this.
Right,
that's a factual question. You know, has we used it to determine reasonability in terms of rates? The answer is no.
Right. That's the question.
Yeah. And so I hope that.
Yeah.
But
I think what came out of the case. I mean, I've at least heard some stories of cities that may have been doing arbitrary things with different people, and they change their practices so that they're treating everyone uniformly. So I think that's what came out of the case.
And the other thing that came out of that case that was significant is that, it's the first line, that you're charged for service outside must be based. It's got to be reasonable. Just as you don't say it specifically, you say it further down. But the same constitutional standard applied to a retail customer outside of the city as inside of the city to provide water at reasonable rates. And then it's up to, there's the whole fact question about how you get to reasonableness, and a court can certainly determine that it's not reasonable. In that case, they said, yeah, we don't see it here, but that's what the court does, is it resolves those issues.
And that's okay. and that translates to, you know, again, if somebody in Mill Creek, you know, says, I don't like this, then there is a cause of action.
Right.
And what are the side rails? You know.
Right.
It's, you go to where the law has been. So.
Okay. I just was wondering if anybody's used to change a rate.
That's just in my little quiet sphere. You know, maybe somebody else has.
Well, if anyone knows litigation, I know.
But I think that with lots of things. Oh, sorry for jumping in. I think with lots of things, the understanding that rule exists and that it does provide a sidebar gets you into the chute so that you can resolve questions without having to go to court because you know what the question to ask. Even though there are different fact patterns.
Fred?
One of the comments, if you're looking for things that you might put in the municipal code to kind of provide side rails, is to somehow bring the concept of the Supreme Court and make that applicable to the sale of surplus contracts, so that the standard from the Tory case ends up also in municipal code. You can sell surplus at reasonable rates, you know, and bring that kind of concept over and put it in the statute as well.
Okay. Any other comments about this point?
On a side note, one of the solutions that could be possible for ratepayers in various areas is that, in our case, the Division of Public Utilities did an extensive study before the PSC made that decision. They actually did a comprehensive rate study of, if the city took it over, this is what would happen. But in that process, there were some discoveries made, and that's why the Division of Public Utilities findings, they could be the third-party arbitrator when a person has a problem with the rate structure. There has to be a disinterested party that actually reviews those rates, and the Division of Public Utilities is perfect. The state already has them, and they have great skills and professionals that can do an in-depth dive. Is this legit? Is this right? Or is it arbitrary? So that's why the PSC held, because they found that in that case, there was no way to determine how the rates were structured by the entity purchasing, so it was in the best interest for the water users that were petitioning to remain with the water users and do an alternative approach, and that was purchase the water system.
Okay. I mean, unfortunately, or fortunately or unfortunately, at least the way this law is currently configured, except for the case where a private water company comes into a city, I think the statutes and the Constitution are pretty clear that the PSC is not going to regulate cities. So that would be a major lift to change that.
Can do things.
Yeah, there's both constitutional prohibition and statutory prohibitions in the PSC code against that. So that's a big lift to change that.
As someone who has litigated before the PSC and private water company rates, it's not a particularly satisfying experience. Very expensive proposition. The PSC hates dealing with water companies. We've got a former commissioner sitting here. Maybe he could tell you his experience.
Well, it's true. When I was on the commission, rather than deal with the small water companies, we encouraged them to be mutually owned so they could set their own rates, because there's just not... The economies of scale are awful, and it's hard to set rates that are fair and not astronomical under those situations. And for better or for worse, Paulina, I'm glad I wasn't... I was there before, and I was... thereafter, but I wasn't there during your kids.
That window of opportunity.
The regulatory costs are rarely worth it for small water companies, because the cost that gets passed on to the consumer is just horrendous.
It's not an inexpensive process. I mean, as you found out, I don't think it's less expensive than court, but it's full on.
But the review of rates cannot. If everybody were altruistic and fine and wonderful, we wouldn't have the doubts and questions we have. But the key here is there are some situations where it's arbitrary, and there needs to be a mechanism for relief for those that have been offended by the process.
Well, the question is the court the only remedy?
Right now, I think the courts are the only remedy. I think that's actually what they said in... Platt versus Torrey was, for people outside the municipal boundary, court is your remedy. If you're inside the boundary, you can go to the city first.
We came very close to PSC jurisdiction. We were within one breath away from passing it. So it's not impossible if the right facts are presented. The people's body, we have a public legislature, and if they knew all the facts in a simple format, they would be good people,
and good decisions. And you know, judicial review should be a last step in a series of opportunities for recourse. It shouldn't be the first. And if our system, if we believe that our system is created around a court case that says that the courts are the only remedy for recourse, I think that's a fundamental problem with our government. And the court should be the last recourse for judicial review. There should be other opportunities for remedy. So I think that's another question for our attorneys. What recourse does exist short of judicial review, and if it is inadequate, then that may be another legislative opportunity we should consider. That should never be the first or only recourse.
Okay.
Because I am curious, Boyd, about when we looked at that, in your sheet here, you have... Are we convinced that under Article 6, Section 28, the legislature has no power over this issue?
With the Ripper Clause, the case law interpreting it.
So are you trying to tell me you're going to go to the legislature and say you can't regulate rates outside the city's boundaries? The
Constitution would say they can't do that.
but these are for residents outside the municipal boundary. They have a power to certainly protect their interests, to make sure they're being taken care of. The courts can't be your only remedy, Steve.
Well, why can't you then mediate or arbitrate? But you can't always litigate. That is your constitutional right to get access to the courts. And that provides a good remedy for most people. And the reality is, the only rape case I'm aware of is the Tory case. Like Scott says, it's been used for other reasons, but not to challenge rates. That is our standard. And reasonableness is fact determinative, and the court's going to have to arbitrate that. That's what they do.
Well, I guess I have a hard time thinking I can go and tell a legislator they can't. They have no power to protect residents in Mill Creek and others. Yes, and it doesn't go succeed very often.
No, but
it's called the Constitution.
Well, I'm not convinced that that's the Ripple Clause has been used by cities all the time to try and stop things.
Have you read anything?
That's very successful.
I have. They seem to understand it very well.
That's what Fred wanted to tell me way back when. But look, we won.
Anyway. Why did the legislature waste that time on that Public Service Commission case way back when, Fred? Why did you even take that legislation up if it had no power?
They tried to get the legislature to take it up, and they couldn't get it out of the Judiciary Committee.
Okay.
And the only thing that could pass was the resolution to study it. So we studied it and couldn't get anybody to put together any kind of agreement to give the Public Service that commission that jurisdiction. The Public Service Commission said, we do have it under this limited situation and nobody appeals. But the move to make city decision subject to Public Service Commission jurisdiction would be quite a battle.
And I'm not saying that's the solution. What I'm saying is the elephant in the room is residents that live outside a municipal boundary who have rates that are different than within the city. They have no remedy at the ballot box. And that's what you got to provide them other than Tory. I think if the work of the committee is just say, no, everything is fine, we're just going to let people go and they can either leave the city or they can just find water elsewhere, which you cannot do.
Or we can, it's just expensive.
You just have to move, right? But see, as a resident of Mill Creek, I don't like the idea that I have no real say in what my water rates are going to be forever. I can't annex it to the city. And when we sought to annex it to the city years ago, the city rejected it. You know, so the city can't provide water and not take the area. We just can't dance around the issue because that's the issue that why we're meeting.
Well, that's, if I can clarify, that's one part. And I don't even know that it's the most, it is an important part. From what I've heard the debate, the most important part was how do we make sure people don't get cut off with some random choice that's never ever happened and that we're aware of on a large scale. But that seemed to be the most important. Rate setting, yeah, that does matter, and maybe we need to look for ways to provide additional assurances or opportunities. But if we're going down the road of there needs to be a state entity or a legislative created entity to do that, that's a whole different discussion than can we find a way to work it into how the municipalities do their business. And I don't know what the answer to that is yet, but I think...
I understand, Mark. I'm just saying we have to keep it in mind because I know last session I heard that. It was not an issue that was being ignored.
And as the sponsor of this legislation, I can tell you what my intent has been. We don't need to speculate on that. All of these issues are incredibly important, and the disenfranchisement piece is huge. The risk of termination is huge. The lack of recourse is huge. These all dovetail each other, and the concerns that we're addressing are we're still dancing around some unanswered questions, legal questions, but absolutely, these are all at the heart of why we're here together, why Natural Resources Committee created this.
Okay.
I have one more comment, please.
Yes.
This goes to Mr. Meekin. The Public Service Commission, when you were not on there, was hearing this case, but there were some egregious issues that arose. The PSC wanted this legislation, and the county, Salt Lake County, wanted it because of fire flows. There was infrastructure that didn't meet standards necessary to protect the public. And that area served outside the city boundaries had some serious, serious issues. So they wanted it for the East Bench. We were okay on that point, but the reason the PSC wanted it and the county wanted it and the fire marshals wanted it is because there are some issues on the East Bench where he lives, Holiday, where there are some serious problems. But without a rate, this would actually work to the benefit. Laura said to me, but people don't like the rates that we charge now. And I said, if you were honest to say and show a map, which we have, of where the infrastructure doesn't meet those standards, that are still not meeting those standards back from 1991 today, then people would be more apt to pay more if they had a true cost-based rate structure for the people being served. And when you say you have a service area and it goes beyond the city boundaries, you can't just stop if you're providing retail service. The state engineer is being told that this is my service area to cover those water rights that are being used so they don't lose them. Then that's the service area. We can't have it one way presented and then another way presented. Whatever the state engineer has been reported to, that this is my service area, that they need to accept for these purposes of rates. It is a full-fledged service area. It isn't like I'm just piping surplus water to another retail provider. There is a human responsibility and to repair, maintain, but nobody really wants to look at that because it's underground. We can do all the things above ground because that's what people see. And they're marvelous at doing that. But there is a necessity that Salt Lake City needs to deal with those that infrastructure that's gone to hell.
Okay. On that statement, I'm going to move on to number 8 because yes. I think it gets to that observation. Cities may be giving different water customers outside their boundaries different expectations about the service to anticipate, and that view may change with time. Since all such service necessarily relies on a finding by the municipality that they have surplus to make available, any time-based assurances provided by a city in contract or otherwise to customers outside their boundary are likely ultra vires, meaning not authorized. The only way they can assure customers outside their boundary that service will continue is to operate in a way that the surplus capacity persists and the elected leaders of the municipality remain supportive of making it available outside their boundary. No Utah court has addressed what limits may apply to either the termination or continuation of service outside a city's political boundaries. I think that's where we're at, to be honest.
I think you said it very well, and I think that's the reason why this your board needs to come up with some kind of an arbitration method between being served by somebody you can't vote for and going to court. There are too many cities involved which could go to court, but there are also too many individuals involved that can't go to court, and little water services that can't. And it isn't okay to let people build houses that last for 60 years when they don't have an assured water supply. And that's basically what's really wrong, is that this is imaginary water. It comes to your house today, but tomorrow you won't be able to flush.
But the reality is they have been able to do it for 60 years.
But the things are different.
Yeah.
I agree with Mark Stratford. This is the key issue of what the reliability of water supply. I think that this paragraph could benefit by a sentence that maybe starts it out saying something like, water is a essential public service and there's an expectation of long-term or perpetual service. That's why this paragraph outlines the problem we're trying to deal with.
Get authorization from the constitutional change so you could deal with this. This is another kind of provision that could be included in the legislative authorization to sell water outside the county.
Okay. Any other comments on this one?
Yeah, just one. Okay. Briefly, I think that in summary is why we're trying to get this thing solved. Because of the perception that's out there that, in fact, a municipal entity can somewhat willy-nilly come in and simply terminate a contract because they want to. And I think both the state engineer's comments and the willingness of all of us to come here and spend hours working on this is indicative of the fact that we are trying to find a solution to that. And I think what Fred's comment is that we need to find and make the appropriate constitutional restructuring and the appropriate under-structuring statutes to make this work is why we're kind of all here. And the rest of it, kind of making a little comparison when the legislature decides they want to force people to really find out what the real rates and costs are, I go back about 24 years when the development community decided that impact fees were unreasonable and unfair. And they decided that every city would be required to do a rate study and determine what their impact fees should be. What was the result of that?
High impact fees.
Every single city in the state, impact fees went up. And so I think we need to think carefully before we start asking for questions and delving into those questions that we're not sure what the answer is going to be. But I think Representative Coleman and her efforts to go forward on transparency are not only laudable, but we should move forward on those. We should move forward on the ability to find out what we're charging, who we're serving, and what our service areas are. I think that ought to be easily discoverable and easily discoverable by the public and a matter of public record. So in that, I think that's part of the reason why at least on behalf of our clients, we're willing to sit here for hours and try and get this resolved. I think it's an important thing to resolve. So I think your efforts on that part and the efforts of everybody here is valuable. But ultimately, that's what we should be focused on.
Okay. So my concern is as we have some parallel efforts here. I would be very, very concerned about changing the Constitution or proposing a constitutional change that conforms to current practices if we don't have simultaneous legislation that protects water users in all of these issues that we've been discussing. I'm not sure what I've seen so far in a constitutional proposal I think it doubles down on risk and disenfranchisement. And so if we can't get these two pieces together where there's statutory protection along with a constitutional change, or we need a different constitutional change. We still have disagreement on what the Constitution really says.
And I think let's not be too hard on the Constitution Committee yet, because that's why they asked to meet with us today, is they were proposing changes to the Constitution and they wanted to get together and talk about what statutory changes might go with that to get the solution that we need. And so I think that's the whole reason they're here today. So let's not burn the bus right yet.
Right, right. Well, and that's my point, is while we have these two committees together, I'm glad they come together, because we really can't do one without the other. We can't have the Constitution conform to current practices if we're not statutorily providing protection.
Okay. Cameron?
I want to piggyback on something Craig said, because I think it's an important parallel. Craig referenced the modernization of the Impact Fees Act 20-some odd years ago. And as the same people in the room know, impact fees are so controversial. Is that a fair statement?
That's a fair statement.
But what's interesting about the impact fees process is that a developer who is assessed an impact fee gets that fee that comes from a study that the city council approves. But that developer generally is not a resident of the city where he or she is developing. So the city, the elected officials, who are duly elected by the residents, do the study, figure out what the costs are. There's legislative guidelines for what impact fees can be charged for, but there's no predetermined outcome of what the impact fee is, because ultimately the impact fee is going to be drastically different if you are St. George here to my left because of the topography versus, say, Sandy or Ogden because of the topography, climate, and everything else. So there's no constitutional or statutory, in the case of impact fees, no statutory outcome, and the impact fee is only X. Instead, it provides a process for the developer of that property to understand what's being charged and then being able to go before the city council, because realistically that developer, he or she does not live in the city where that impact fee study was done and where that impact fee is being charged. So I think, Craig, it's an excellent example that has some parallels to this conversation about the cost of infrastructure, recognizing that costs are going to be different in different places, and recognizing that this whole idea of the term that keeps being used is disenfranchisement. And I wonder, how are you disenfranchised if you were never enfranchised in the first place? If you were never a resident of the city and you were never a voter in the city, you can't be disenfranchised. If anything, you are being provided with an opportunity to participate in the process of setting rates in a way that is above and beyond what is legally required. So if anything, that should be a positive rather than criticized. And I think the underlying question of making sure that there's sufficient supply, again, that's the parallel with impact fees. The idea is you have to look 6 years in advance and you have to kind of go through these steps. When you meet those steps, you set the fee and you provide that infrastructure.
Repeat what I think I just heard, that someone cannot feel disenfranchised if they were never originally franchised. I think we have a whole lot of civil law precedents, civil rights precedents on that holy cow. And I may have just misunderstood that.
So let me make sure we're clear, because I was using the context of the impact fee example that Craig referenced. If I own property in a city where I do not vote, the city sets an impact fee rate, I am not a resident of that city, so I do not vote out in or out the city council member. So, yet I own property within that city, the impact fee applies to that property. There's a process in place by statute that gives me a voice as the city is putting together their impact fee study. So, I, as a property owner in that city, have never had the right to vote. in that city, even though I'm a property owner, because I'm a resident of another city. But through the Impact Fee Act, I do have a voice within the city. I'm just not I'm not enfranchised with the vote because I reside somewhere else. You can only vote in one city. And so that was the example that I was using as a parallel to say that if I don't reside in the city but I receive water services, yes, I don't have the vote, but we can ensure that there's a good process in place to make sure my voice is heard, even though my voice is not a vote.
So I think that takes us back to, you know, problem, and that's a jurisdictional water distribution where the extra jurisdictional folks don't have options. And I think that's the ultimate in inequity.
And I think that's what this observations are supposed to help us recognize, is that that's where we're at today.
Which seems like it goes to number 9.
Which goes directly to number 9. So if it's all right, I'll read to that, because I really want to get to the other items on the agenda. This is taking longer than I was anticipating. While municipalities may choose to make their rate-setting process for those outside their boundary appear transparent and include input from those paying the rates, they are under no statutory or constitutional obligation to do so. If those customers don't like the service they are receiving, their choice is to seek it elsewhere or seek a court review of the rate as reasonable in Platt versus Torrey.
In addition to that, you've got Section 54-2-135, which is the PSC statute that expressly exempts cities, towns, counties, water conservancy districts, improvement districts, or other governmental units from regulation by the PSC. That's what the legislature did in response to the earlier case.
Yeah, that it's in statute and constitution. So,
Steve, does that include circumstances where there's a monopoly?
City is a monopoly for most services.
And regulated.
That's the question outside their bounds,
so
though.
Regulated.
So, cities don't have a water franchise authority outside their boundaries, and customers outside their boundaries have essentially excluded themselves from representation in the municipality's function by failing to annex.
And I did. And that's the last sentence I object to. Because okay, a lot of those citizens have not had any opportunity to annex, and the city may not have even wanted them. That's the history we have to deal with. And what do you deal with citizens that wanted to go into the city, they didn't take them, and now they are part of another city? So you just have to, I just think that sentence is unfair, in that it doesn't acknowledge the fact that some of these citizens did not have a chance to annex. And that's where a lot of this problem arises, because a certain city chose not to annex and follow their water service.
Okay. Let me underline that.
Other than that, it's a very fair paragraph.
Okay. And I wanted to be clear, that wasn't my language.
Yeah, that was me.
Not your language.
I wrote that.
Okay. You haven't fessed up to your 2 lines yet.
I fessed up to the one earlier.
But boy, under the Constitution and the process that they put in the statutes a long time ago, there were 2 ways to share water from a city to non-residents. The first one was annexation. And if that wasn't available, then the legislature authorized in the code to surplus water sales outside. So those are the 2 options that you have. And if annexation doesn't fail or doesn't work for whoever reason, whoever made the decision, then the surplus is the next option, or that service outside that area. So you were too far off the way you wrote it, so don't back up too far.
Well, and I think what I'm probably not acknowledging is that most of the people who are receiving service now didn't make that decision. They bought into it later, maybe unknowingly.
Well, yeah, after somebody else made the decision in 1930.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, you know, we need to distinguish our, the Salt Lake City model versus what happens in other areas of the state, where generally we're not looking to acquire those areas and service towns, but for some reason they have reliability problems or other issues, and they're coming to the cities and saying, help us, because we're right next door and we're having trouble operating this water system.
And you guys have built a system that is reliable and secured sources to do so, and on the backs of your taxpayers, you did so.
And I can tell you that
right.
We also help an adjacent private, you know, that it's a public water system, but with that subdivision where they have needed help, and so we sometimes have to supply them water.
And in some cases, Sean, you guys undertook debt.
Right.
To create that system, you did?
Well, we did the interconnections so that we could help them in those situations, because we don't want someone being without water in the summertime when, you know, it's fire season, or not being able to supply drinking water to them. So it's not just, we can't look at it as just one reason, and that's why I think what Cameron was trying to explain before
right.
We do these surveys. It's just giving a yes or no does not give the full perspective of what's going on out there.
So is it safe to say then that history is important?
Yes, absolutely.
Got it. Thanks.
Okay. All right.
I can step down now, right?
You're excused.
Does anyone feel compelled to say something else about this one, or should we move on? Okay. 10. Water service outside a city's boundary complicates state water planning, since numbers reported may or may not include surplus water sales. Potentially affected values are population, connections, wholesale deliveries. This issue is further complicated when developments employ master meters to circumvent drinking water rules within a development. And I don't know if that only happens outside of cities, or do these master meter things happen inside city boundaries?
They do.
Yes. So they do. That problem applies
that's
both sides
that's
then.
Across the state.
Okay.
I didn't propose a change there, but I think there's some loaded language in that statement. But
you think this statement was put together by a certain office?
I'm just saying I didn't object to change it, but it's a general observation.
I was throwing in nuts and bolts at this point. We had invited Drinking Water to talk more about that, and we haven't given them a chance to talk about it yet. So I was trying to keep it in my mind that there's an issue here that I don't really understand. So, okay. So if it's all right, we'll just move past that. Okay. And 11, issues associated with retail delivery of water to a particular area are not necessarily the same as circumstances where a city has a wholesale contract or a contract for water use in an area that is not part of the retail delivery system, which I think gets to what you have been
saying. Yeah, that's
before.
A serious point.
Yeah. That there are two different sets of issues. All right. I'm sorry that took so long, Steve. I wanted to give you a chance to do your constitutional amendment.
It's been a good discussion.
So, if it's all right, we'll move on to the what the Constitution Committee has
so
provided.
Steve's and solve
Steve
all the problems.
Yeah.
But we're trying with this proposed amendment to take the reality we're seeing on the ground and look at the various circumstances that are there. We have talked with the league. The cities pretty uniformly are not willing to give up their constitutional prohibition on selling their water rights. They do not want to have that risk. And again, this came into the Constitution in 1896 in response to a situation in Ogden where the city had made an improvident move.
Yeah.
And we've given Mark no end of grief about that over our discussion.
Mark was the attorney on the case.
He still looks good, doesn't he?
Well, the interesting thing is, I don't know why it became such a big issue, because it sounded like they came out really good on the deal.
At the end of the day, it probably did. But the reality is, this is a good protection and a hedge against short-term economic decisions being made by city elected officials that really don't look out for the long-term futures of their communities. And that's why it's there, and it's served the state well. And the surplus sale under 10.8.14 has accommodated a lot of what's going on. Notwithstanding that, it is subject to termination. It's more theoretic than real, but it is. And so we're attempting to address those situations. But in deference to the RIPRA clause and the legislative authority of cities, we're suggesting we talked about public water supplies. We're talking about designated service areas that are determined by the municipalities themselves and defined by ordinance, which is a public legislative process that gives notice and opportunity to anyone who wants to attend and discuss and be part of that process. And then as we get into line 38 or subsection 3, these are attempting to address the current realities. A is dealing with contractually committing water in excess of the needs of its designated service area for use outside that service area. This is the Salt Lake City scenario, providing water under contract to, say, the town of Alta or to private individuals in the canyons, where the city does not have a retail service system. The economics of trying to run a retail service system from Salt Lake City or the county up those canyons is prohibitive. And so this has been a way that has allowed that to happen. Subsection B, line 41, is basically the Salt Lake County East Bench scenario, where the city has made the commodity of water available to retail customers within a designated service area. And C was the existing constitutional language that allows the exchange of water works and water supply of equal value to meet the municipal needs. And so we're trying to, within the constitutional framework, basically validate what is going on, but preserving the constitutional prohibition against permanently alienating water rights, as the League has indicated, their members are not supportive of that. Now, if that changes, that could go away. But in the meantime, this is attempting to build into the Constitution the reality of what's gone on, to allow some permanence, to validate the sale in the Salt Lake County area, as an example, under Section B, that this, they can sell the commodity of water to customers within their service area. That does not violate the Constitution under this amendment as proposed. And unfortunately, the dialogue continues to be Salt Lake City-centric, but as we're hearing, this is a statewide issue. This is not just Salt Lake City or Sandy City. Provo does it, and many other communities, and we've heard Sean from St. George does it. This is something that's gone on everywhere as a reasonable accommodation. The reasons why will vary, as many as you can think of. But this proposed amendment, I think, will get us where we're trying to go. And if your surplus sales then works within that framework, say, yes, we can do that. I don't care if you build in a mediation or arbitration type approach to resolving rate disputes, but I think we've already had the legislature pass on the fact that the PSC is not going to regulate, and the RIPRA clause of the Constitution, I think if it ever got interpreted, would prohibit that anyway, because the legislative functions of a municipality, which is rate making, cannot be delegated to other commissions. That's the Constitution. And we've seen that over and over again in RIPRA clause litigation. But there's nothing that would prevent parties from mediating or arbitrating before you go to the court, which is the town of Torrey, ultimate remedy. And I agree with Representative Coleman, litigation's expensive, it ought to be a last resort. But what are the intermediate steps? Well, those are the traditional alternative dispute resolutions. They're there. They ought to be exercised. there's nothing that prohibits people on a voluntary basis from doing that today. But we could certainly codify that within your surplus sales stuff. But I think from what you've discussed here today, what you're proposing is compatible with what we've proposed here as a constitutional amendment. And I think they'll dovetail pretty well, at least from my perception, but I'm open to dialogue.
Fred?
One of the things we've used in the past when we needed a change in the Constitution but also needed legislation to be supportive of it, you'd have one piece would be the constitutional change, which is a resolution. And the second piece becomes the legislation that becomes effective upon the passage of the constitutional change. So that way you are able to lay out what the parameters are before it goes to the people for the vote, and they know that if they pass that constitutional amendment, these will be the rules. And that's a process that we've utilized in the past. Works pretty good when you're dealing with a constitutional issue that needs clarifying, you know, legislation. And that way, everybody that are parties to this can see what it really is and how the two work together. And I think this is probably the most open vetted situation that I've seen in a long time with the number of people that are working on four different working groups that you have. But that's the way you would structure it. If there, you have the constitutional changes, and if they allow you to do that, then you draft the legislation that gives a warm, fuzzy feeling. I don't think you put arbitration into a constitutional change, but you may create some sort of process to take a look at reasonableness.
I agree that ought to be statutory. The Constitution sets the policy, statutes implement it, and that's how you need to function. The detail has to come in statutory provisions.
I just want to make one comment that as the work and the effort that's gone into this, I'm trying to find, without telling you about what Fred is saying, of trying to find that fine line as to what we include in the Constitution and what we include in statutory underpinnings to support the changes proposed in the Constitution is a difficult task, and I think this committee has done a great job in trying to identify where that line, because that line is seldom bright. But I think including those necessary and while retaining the ability of the municipalities by ordinance to establish their service areas and those other issues has been a key factor, and with what we have drafted here, I would feel I've been authorized by our clients to go ahead and support this effort.
We, from the league, we're still having some discussions, but I will say this. Steve has taken the laboring work on drafting this, and we think it works as a committee. It just is, it's very simple, straightforward, and provides wide latitude for the other committees to do their jobs legislatively. And that's where, as was said, that's where the detail needs to be, not in the Constitution.
And I want to agree with Sean. Our internal committee at the league has looked at this. There are a couple of words that are still bringing some discussion. We have to take it to our board and to our policy committee. They don't meet until later this summer. So that's why we don't have an official position. But our internal group, several of whom are sitting around this room here, and we have 20 or so cities that have been participating in our internal group, are comfortable with this direction, with the understanding that there are still a couple of words that people are considering.
The concept that I think really helps is the inclusion in the constitutional change for this concept of the designated water service area. And then that provides the opportunity then to go into the statute and put things that, you know, bring good feelings to everybody about what happens in those designated services. And that provides the basis for being able to work the resolution. between the recommendations of the Constitution and the changes that we've been talking about in surplus and water coming here.
Okay. Other thoughts? Yes.
Question. This term is designated water service area. How does this affect the extraterritorial jurisdiction?
I don't think it does, but I don't.
They're
really two different things. The extraterritorial jurisdiction is dealing with water quality source protection. This is where you can provide service. And I view them as very different in terms of what their statutory functions are.
When you say extraterritorial,
that is for watershed quality, water quality source protection.
What?
This is talking about delivery of water service.
And let's take an example. City or water system serves the water beyond the city boundary. So in the canyons, it will become a designated water service area, but it's outside the city boundary. So this extraterritorial, how do you define it?
I don't know. It's not my committee.
You're invited to come at
1:30, Steve.
Yeah, that'll be a lively debate, I'm sure. Yes.
Presently, it would. There'd be numerous ways to create quote unquote service areas. Presently, when municipalities, and I believe as well service districts, although I'm not sure on the service districts, when those municipalities put in change applications that extends water outside their municipal bounds, they're currently required to file a map with the state engineer's office, and that in fact extends their service area. So are you talking about that service area, or are you talking about a circumstance where a municipality otherwise defines a service area by an ordinance? And that's a big question here. And then the other thing is in the proposed language at line 39, where they're proposing to allow them to contractually sell water in excess of their needs outside their service area. Is that service area the one that's required by the change application process to be filed by the municipality, or is that a service area that is can be defined by ordinance by the municipality? And A, you'd have to straighten that out. And then the other thing, the bigger picture, is that the original Constitutional Convention, when they discussed why they had this section of the Constitution, it was specifically discussed that the state was going to be the repository to be in trust for all the people in the state, and that the water was going to be used as opposed to not used. And I think why some of these things cropped up, Mr. Clyde notes that, presently there are not just Salt Lake City, but other municipalities as well are serving extraterritorially outside their bounds. But the question really is, how many of those municipalities are serving extraterritorially outside their municipal bounds and not providing water to some people in their service area? That's the question.
In 1992, we learned that there were 107 municipalities that were serving outside their boundaries. So today, 50% roughly of the cities are providing.
But I think the issue, the reason we looked at this on the Constitutional Committee was the acknowledgement that the cities ought to be able to define their service area. This is not change application service area. This is basically looks at sort of more the concept of the map that Representative Coleman was looking at. Is the city having an opportunity to say, we provide water within this service area, here's our limits, and that those people within there, they're treated the same. So it's a recognition that water within that service area is not terminable, it's going to continue, they will have their processes put in place. And so it just recognizes basically what is reality of what is happening. And so the language, yes, I mean, we looked at the language. Service area, to me, is not the same thing at all as the change application issue. This is the municipal boundary. So if the city has a change application, whether it says that it can use their water right with anywhere within their boundaries, I would assume that meant anything within this designated service area. That would be their boundary as far as water service.
So, Paul, isn't that one of the problems we have right now, is service areas not clearly defined?
It is the concern that a judge could easily look at the existing constitutional language and limit it to the municipal boundary, political boundary, which then creates this situation, the nightmare scenario, I call it, where a city by constitution, you know, someone could say, no, these rights, these water is terminable outside our political boundaries, even though we have, in effect, provided water to this area for decades, and the infrastructure has been put into place to provide service from them based on either different rate structure or taxes, bonds, etc. So this is what is needed to make legal that which is already happening. And then, as Fred pointed out, in the legislation, we can deal with some of the other issues. But we need to have the constitutional. We need to make everything legal so that we don't have that nightmare scenario of some judge deciding that what we have been doing is not valid. We have had that happen a few times, and we've ended up spending a lot of time and effort resolving that.
The other thing, Representative Coleman, is that we also took out the language of just inhabitants, because we were concerned that inhabitants really implies living within the defined boundary of the city itself. And so designated service area would give the cities the ability as a legislative function by ordinance to determine what that designated service area ought to be. The change application process has nothing to do with the city. You define your place of use in a water right by 40-acre quarter-quarter sections. That isn't my little individual lot, but that's the definitive nature you have to go to in water rights these days. Yes, that could be changed, but for a place of use within a change application is defined, should not be determinative of where a city is extending its municipal services. They're just totally different concepts, different regulatory bodies, and the state engineer simply does not have that jurisdictional function to determine those kinds of things, and it would be a mistake to try and put it there. It's not their role.
So
you don't want it, do you, Wood?
Well, no, and that's what I was going to say. I think we've already taken the broad view that the city service area is wherever they serve water, and it changes as the city grows.
Yeah.
And so...
I might be going on.
Well, I've got the recorders.
Okay. All right.
So I have two questions, and because I'm not hearing everything very well. Is Paul suggesting that we may have activity that is not legal?
No. My own view is I just worry about a judge. We had the situation arise where the Supreme Court held that what the state engineer had been doing for decades was not valid. And the legislature had to spend a long time to resolve that. And my attitude is, let's just clarify any ambiguity. And I think we have ambiguities in the existing constitutional language. And I think we would make all sorts of arguments that what we are doing is legal, but I'd rather not take the risks, so let's clarify the language.
I see. And the second question is, I'm not the biggest on grammar, but it seems to me the Constitution, the pronoun it is referencing the municipality, not some other type of created entity like a service district. I mean, clearly, when it says it's, you know, that is the municipality.
Uh-huh.
The Constitution representative only applies to municipalities. It doesn't affect districts or other
right.
political subdivisions. They function under their own statutory framework.
Right. So we would seek to change that?
No, because districts have latitude to serve outside their boundaries today, and many of them do.
And we don't have constitutional restrictions on the districts.
That's correct.
I do think in the statute that we're talking about, whatever that ends up looking like, it might apply more broadly than to cities, that so that there are similar protections if you're in a district or a city. But as far as the Constitution goes, the language there only applies to the cities.
Right. Would it... I mean, I don't know if I'm changing the discussion, but would it be fair to say that one of the accompanying pieces of legislation that should go with this is how a city would designate their service area so that it's clear how that works?
Again,
no,
in
a statute.
They would do it by ordinance. And again, there is a very established process that cities go through to adopt an ordinance that is notice and public hearing and opportunity for dialogue. But that is purely a legislative function by cities. And so, again, we'll run afoul of the Constitution if we try by statute to dictate how cities perform their legislative function. That RCRA clause says they cannot delegate that legislative authority to other commissions or other bodies or the legislature. That's what they do as municipal government.
I think, boy, by statute, you can specify, for example, that once a city has designated a service area, they should notify, for example, the state engineer what that designated area is, for example, and to publish it, you know, give notice of it. But as far as how it's setting it up, that's the city function.
Okay.
But by statute, we can spell out, then, what do they do with that information?
And we do, as Steve pointed out, it does state in our proposal that the municipality would do it by ordinance. I would clarify that currently, under current law, there are only certain ordinances that require a public hearing. Others don't require a public hearing, but they have to be adopted in a public meeting. All things, again, that we could address
by legislatively. Statute. In Title 10.
I like the idea that the proposed language says in the Constitution that the city or municipality adopts it by ordinance.
Yeah. And then as far as your grammar, representative, I don't think this language has been seen by legislative research yet.
Well, yeah, they've seen it.
Have they?
Amy's been in our meetings.
Okay. What about the word it's? I think it's fine myself. But
they haven't commented one way or the other on it.
They may.
They were present at the meeting.
Okay, well, I was a poli-sci major, so don't ask me to look at it. But I feel good about the language, and frankly, if we could come to an agreement on the constitutional language, that would go a long ways to then sort of laying out what we have to do statutorily to, you know, address other issues. This will in effect address a lot of the you know, reliability of your service area issue to a great extent, because then the cities will have to then by ordinance determine this is where we provide, you guys have permanent water supply, these are ones we do by contract. At least as Richard says, people need to know where they stand. That's the key. By contract, you do planning if you know what your water supply is, but you have to have that knowledge.
Yes.
Steve, in your view, would these changes that are proposed, would a city be able to exclude some portion of their existing municipal boundary from service?
I don't think they can, because of other laws that if you're a resident of the city, then you get other obligations to your residents. What we're attempting to address here is outside that residential boundary issue and validate what's currently being done. But you've got a whole different body of law to deal with what your rights are as a resident of the city.
Steve, what about the situation where there's a city, a portion of the city that is serviced by either another city or by a private company, and you know it's gone for a long period of time, and yet it sounds to me like the municipal boundary would at least be their service area. How is that addressed?
I don't know how you deal with an internal competitor, whether it's a district or another regulated utility or somebody that's providing water. It happens. It's kind of like White City and Sandy.
It's Holiday Water Company exists. Yeah. There's other cities who receive a lot of their water from districts. For example, Draper City.
Water Pro.
I think what happens, this is one of the reasons why we wanted the city to set their designated service area, because it may not be the same as everything in the municipality, but as long as those people have water supplies, then they have protections under the Title 10, the code. What the city has to do is just make sure everyone within their city has that water, whether they provide it themselves within their service area or provide it through these other entities. That's how it's taken care of.
It's not unheard of, and we have, for example, in St. George, south of the Virgin is the Dixie REA providing power, another public power entity. And then St. George City provides power north of the river. And we just have our areas designated, and we service within those areas. So that's not a hurdle, I don't think.
And that's why I like the designated service area. Yeah. And that can change. Except, I don't think you can contract it, for certain things, but I'm not going to worry about that.
We do have some areas north of the Virgin that are they are unincorporated, and they are developable, that are technically in Dixie's service area, but we imagine that we'll come up with another agreement and adjust our boundaries, and do whoever is closest and most economical, we'll just adjust
in
that way.
And
that's how water
works. New entities have come in and they ended up trading resources and doing things. Or like when Sandy broke off from Sully County Water Conservancy District into a metro district, there was a lot of separation of assets and a lot of bonded debt and other things worked out.
Well, I think that's what you address in lines 36 and 37. That's why you have to have those lines in there. And that, so we just need the league to buy off on it officially.
Boyd, can I ask one other question?
You bet.
And I don't want the question to be, it really is a question, it's not necessarily an opinion, and I know there's two sides to this argument, but I notice in line 30 we're striking waterworks out. I know this has been a topic that's been talked about, and I can certainly see both sides of this argument, and clearly there's a little bit of a risk here. I think we just need to acknowledge part of the reason I'm assuming that the original constitution was developed and prohibited the sale of waterworks was again to try to protect city from short-term decisions made that might hurt the city, and even though we're protecting the water rights still, the sale of water works, could potentially go down that same road. I know particularly in the Midwest and the East Coast, there's plenty of examples where cities have sold off their water system and it's turned out to be very negative result for the city. There's been a lot of conversations today about disenfranchising voters, and boy, I can give plenty of examples if you don't know about you know what happens. Now, I have to argue the other side here, though, for a moment, and say I understand why it's there. Also, I don't like, as a municipal representative, I don't like the state coming in and saying this is what you can and can't do. And there may be circumstances where a city, you know, it makes sense for a city to sell portions. I've even worked for cities where water tanks or water lines have been exchanged with adjoining cities where it makes sense. And there's certainly, you know, some common sense there that needs to be taken. But I think there is a risk that I think we have to acknowledge in allowing a city to potentially, you know, wholesale their whole system out to a private vendor. And it could be fine. It could work out fine. There's plenty of examples where it works well, but there's plenty of examples where it goes awry as well.
This is the word that I referenced earlier, that we had some push and pull on within the center groups. You did a nice job outlining both sides of it.
Yeah.
On behalf of the argument to delete that word, the concept is exactly what you described, that if you have a city that owns a waterwork that wants to sell it to an adjacent city because now development is caught up in that area, and City A wants to pass that burden to City B, should there be some flexibility assumed in the Constitution that could have some statutory guidelines? We've also talked about a middle ground where you could specify in the Constitution that you could only alienate that water work if it's going to another supplier of water. So that's in part why I preface my comments about the overall argument in a couple words that are still leading to some discussions among cities because of the varying circumstances that are out there. The other thing that's important to consider, somebody referenced the research going back to the original Constitution Convention when the language was put out. Waterworks meant something different then than it does today. Certainly, there is a broader definition of waterworks in today's society than there was 100 years ago. So that's worthy of discussion too, potentially in statute of what waterworks are tied to the water rights, what waterworks maybe could have a little more flexibility.
I also don't think that while I agree with some of the points you've made, I don't think you've expressed the view on the other side as fully as your fear of alienating them. That is, the power example is a great example. We annexed the area, the ledges in north of St. George. It was in UPNL's territory, Rocky Mountains. So we had to negotiate with them by law in order to purchase that infrastructure. Made sense rather than having three power companies in one city. And it was most economical for the developer to have it within our power system. You also look at what the definition of waterworks is. I agree, very different than now than it used to be. But we could have a situation, and we do have situations, where there's a no man's land between cities. We know that someone's going to annex them. They're both in our policy declaration areas. And someone says, we've got 10 homes here. We want to be served by water, reliable culinary water. And we do that, but if it goes to the other city, we want to be able to say, take the lines and maintain them. But also, we have a treatment facility that was constructed by St. George City, providing culinary water not to just our city, but the cities surrounding us as well. That now is being expanded by the Conservancy District to 80 million gallons per day. And yet, technically, we cannot divest ourselves of that facility. And if that isn't the definition of a waterworks, if someone can carve out a definition that doesn't include a water treatment facility of that size, then I don't know. That's why this is, I think, the language is archaic and probably one of those redundant that attorneys loved to do back then, which is say the same thing five different ways. And so we think that it makes sense to do this. We don't see it being a problem with striking that, and that someone is going to, that there's going to be a city that will have water but sell its water works. to an outside entity. But our first proposal was to say it had to go to another governmental entity, because there might be times when it might make sense to turn it over to the Conservancy District, as in our issue.
And I just want to emphasize what Cameron said, which is maybe this is a statutory thing that we companion, kind of like Fred's been talking about, rather than a constitutional thing. Sorry, Richard.
Oh, I really have a member city.
I mean, that's something I'm saying as well. And I guess I think I heard someone just suggest that there should not be a legislative role I'm a local control person. I typically like to look at the local government empowerment. But there is clearly a role of the state in water use and distribution and regulation. And I don't know the limitations of that, but where the municipalities cannot impose a definite affirmative protection of the users that are extra-jurisdictionally served, I think there's an appropriate state role.
I think that's...
But I just heard someone, I'm sorry, I can't tell who everybody is, but, you know, that there's not a... that there shouldn't be a legislative role. So help me understand what the limits should be constitutionally of the state regarding its political subdivisions.
Mark, I think that's what you were getting at. We just think on the word waterworks, and perhaps if you need some protections, we can put that in the legislation, but take it out of the Constitution.
So I think we're agreeing with you, Representative.
I think we're in agreement with you.
Yes.
On that.
Okay.
That's good information. It sounds like there's been quite a bit of discussion on that.
I think it just looks like a word struck in here, but I think it was debated and discussed seriously before the change was
Not to beat a dead horse, but I think we all recognize, going back to what Fred said earlier, critical and key part of this thing, once we've agreed with the constitutional languages, is the companion legislation that will go with it. How that's debated and how that comes together and what issues are included and not included are going to be critical for everyone involved, municipalities, districts, and everyone else. And I think that's going to be an important discussion over the next month or so.
Well,
it
looks like we've about exceeded everybody's expectations of how long we were going to be here. Richard?
Our meeting's about to end, looking at the clock. I just wanted to say I really like the direction that we're going here, subject to hearing back from the League on official action or tweaking and any of our discussions. I really like this and the concept then of then focusing on the companion legislation.
Okay. Good. Can I leave it today? If you'll take this proposal home and look at it and then start to think about companion legislation that should go with it, and that's where we'll focus on our next meeting. Is that fair?
That's fair.
Okay.
Do you have a next meeting?
We'd better get one. Let's see. How far do we want to go out? I'm wondering if we need to, sooner is better than later, to get back together, if that's possible. I was going to suggest the week of the 24th. The 24th's open for me. I guess that probably really doesn't work.
That week doesn't.
The 20th too soon?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm open on the 20th, but that's probably too soon.
25th?
I'm open on the 25th. I know that's probably a hard week for some people.
I'm traveling.
Yeah. All right, let's go to the next week. The week of the 30th.
Crap.
about...
Is the legislature is in California that week.
Oh.
That's in CSO.
Okay. Can we do with the... Are you still traveling the end of, like, the 27th, Richard? The end of that week? You're out the whole week?
Through August 1st.
Yeah.
Or are you scheduling another joint meeting? Or
no,
and I don't...
Just the surplus water meeting, or what are we scheduling?
I don't know what you want. Are you okay if we have a meeting by ourselves?
Yeah.
And then come back with some ideas.
Who are you asking?
I'm talking to the Constitution Committee.
Okay.
So we're just trying to figure out if we're trying to do a joint meeting or just a meeting of our committee. It sounds like it's just our committee. So, so we'd love to have you here, Representative Coleman. Do we move to the next week? So would you be available the week of the 6th?
I'm available on the 6th. On the 7th is Alex. So
what
those
about the
6th? Are back-to-back legislative conferences.
Grab
but I'm available on the 6th. I don't wait till the next day.
How about we do it on the 6th, 10 o'clock? Going once? Would that work for you, Representative?
I think so.
Okay. Let's plan on the 6th, 10 o'clock in the morning. Thank you, everyone, for your patience. Long meeting, but I appreciate the input. Hopefully.
Steve, do you want to set up a meeting for
not all of us here, but a lot of us do want to try and...
You're going to do a report to the Executive Water Task Force, Steve,
yeah,
on the 26th?
Sure.
Are you planning on doing that on the 26th?
Yes. 26th of this month?
Yeah, of July. There's an Executive Water Task Force meeting that day on the 26th.
So could we meet on the 20th?
We could meet
on the
26th or earlier on the
6th. See, just so you know, from a timing perspective, I don't have a board meeting at the end of August.
Not.
Do we have a need to meet as a constitutional group?
I'm not sure we
do. I think we almost have to. We're waiting on the league for them.
Yeah.
Issue on the waterworks.
Well, that's important, but I think is there reason to get at least some idea of what a statutory draft would look like before the 26th? Not, I don't think before the 26th, no. But I think the discussion needs to be needs to start at some point.
Hey, Craig, I agree with that. I just want to make sure people are clear that I won't have endorsement.
Understood.
I don't know. The board's committee is working on the statute. I don't believe.
Yeah.
So you must have a meeting right after this meeting.
Yeah, you're welcome to come.
I think we need. Steve, let's just wait till we hear back on the. And then if we want to come and listen in on the. These guys, they solve the statutory issues.
Yeah, we'll have it all solved for you.
Excellent.
And we have had some conversations with some potential legislative sponsors, so we've got a few of those lined up.
There's some territorial groups meeting on the 7th.
Right, yes.
I don't know that we need to meet again as a committee, to be honest with you.
Okay.
I think we're in good shape until we hear from the league.
Yeah, I do too.
All right. Anything else? Thank you all for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative.
Caitlin sent out an appointment for the task force meeting on the 26th.
Do you have that on your calendar on the 26th?
I don't have it on my calendar.
I better look. I wasn't in the last one. Oh, but I think James put it on my calendar.
Because that's what I have listed, but maybe I'm wrong. I don't know.
James did put another. Yeah, it's on the 26th at 1:30.
He's here. Oh, great. That's good to know. I'm usually the keeper of the calendar. I actually need trouble.
He's not getting credit to office, but he looks good.
Thank you, Noel.
Well, hopefully we didn't make more enemies than friends today.
No, you did great. You really did. It's just a... Everybody's counting on you.
Yeah,
sure. Really do. July 26th, 1:30, right?
Yes.
Another meeting?
What's that? Well, you guys are staying.